Ladies and gentlemen, we got Dustin Lemick here. How you doing, Dustin?
Hey, Tim. Doing good. I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Excellent. Excellent. We're recording this the first week back from holiday break 2022. And before we hit the record button, we were just kind of catching up on our holiday breaks. And Dustin, you kind of mentioned like you're just on all the time. I can totally relate to that. But you know, it sounds like you got a little bit of time off with your family.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the type of person where even when I try to turn it off, it's hard for me to do. And yeah, we were just catching up, and you know, there's definitely value in just like hitting the off button, no question. But yeah, I got some time. I got some time away with my family, and yeah, it was good. Good holidays.
I don't know if you're the same way, but it sounds like we're very similar in that respect. I did take a little bit of time off, but it's the first time since I started Lucas James that I was purposeful and like just not doing the work thing, but like corporate career, starting a business, you know, I'm just kind of on all the time. And I was talking about this with my team, just like the concept of flow, right? Like Monday through Friday, unless you're like a trust fund baby or we win the lottery, whatever, even if you're a trust fund baby and you work, you have to work. It's a big portion of our existence as people in the US, right? How do you kind of optimize that? And I think for some people, it's like, I need to make sure that my health is in order. I need to make sure that I get sleep. I need to have escapism. I need to like kind of turn off for the family and things like that. And I've been able to kind of operate with, you know, being a dad when I need to be a dad, being a husband when I need to be a husband, be a friend and a son when I need to be those.
Yeah.
And still kind of get the work done. But everybody's different. And now that my team is growing, I got to be careful of like how much of my work ethic I'm projecting. If that makes sense, that's well, like setting real, the example.
There's a real thing to flow. Like you're right, Tim. Like for me, it's more, I don't turn it off for long periods of time. I have to force myself to do that. I try to find some, like you're basically, it's balance, right? Like you're basically saying finding that balance. Like I'm a dad too. And, you know, for me, it's really about finding the balance every day and like trying to not like, I try to get out of the office at like a reasonable time every day if I can. You know, I try to exercise for me is like a hugely balancing effect, right? Like, so, but look, you're totally right. It is hard today when you're balancing, you know, 100 different things. Like, you know, you're an entrepreneur just like I am. And, you know, there's just, you have a lot of responsibilities. And it's one of the hardest parts, I would say, about being an entrepreneur is balancing all of those things in like a healthy way.
Totally. Totally. I got away from working out in the morning. And what I found out about myself is like, because my mind's always on. And when I'm able to get to bed at a decent time, like wake up at a decent time, so I'm not like rushed and then just kind of like beat myself up in the morning, so to speak. Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about things, of course, but it just puts me in a much better rhythm. Mood. And then when I get away from that, I can kind of feel myself out of balance a little bit. And this is something I've worked on over time. I don't know about you, but you know, there was a time when if you're looking at a pie chart, 90% of my thought energy, my time, what I was physically doing tasks was like ambition, work, climbing up the corporate ladder. And there was very little like mental energy, time, or purposefulness in some of the areas that I had just mentioned. And I needed to be very purposeful around that and say like, all right, I need to like literally like turn the phone off, not even like put it away somewhere, but like turn it off when I come home so I could be in dad mode for that time. And you're taking away from one bucket for the other. And I don't know how you do it, but I know you got a lot of stuff on your plate as well.
The way that I do it is, and a lot of people do it this way, is just like calendar blocking and things like that. Like I try to be like, my calendar is by far my most important tool. No question. I'm not alone there. Most people. Right. But I try to be like I try to be purposeful with my calendar. Like I will block time off when I literally will put fake meetings. I'll do things like, cause there's a lot of people that have access to my calendar. Like my whole team, most of my team has access to my calendar in terms of just, and I like it that way. Like I want to be accessible and I should be accessible to my whole team really, for whatever it is. I mean, that's part of my job as a CEO of the company, but also like it gets unruly if you don't. So that's how I do it. Like I do it really by just being pretty thoughtful about how I'm managing my calendar.
I love it. I love it. So for the folks that don't know about Breiko, Dustin's the founder and CEO. They're in the jewelry space. Super interesting business. And, you know, obviously we talked before this, but I'm excited to get this out to the Chicago, Fireside Chicago community. For folks that don't know you, could you just give a quick background on yourself and a little bit about the company?
Yeah, of course. I have kind of a unique background. I actually come from third generation of retail jewelers. My grandfather started our retail organization north side of Chicago in the 50s. And so my whole life, I'm, you know, kind of was brought up and thought pretty much from a pretty young age that I was going to come in and take over our stores and really run our retail operations. And that's what I did for legitimately 13 years. And I started noticing in the industry, like there were all of these problems and pain points that I was personally feeling, all centered around like jewelry insurance, appraisals. The jewelry industry is super archaic. Like not many people truly understand from the outside, understand the inner workings of this industry, but it's like super old school, like as old school as you can possibly imagine. And then marry that up with insurance, which is also a bit on the old, like the old school spectrum, although it's getting much better. Like there's this huge insurtech revolution that's happening, and we're happy to be kind of right in the middle of that. And so, you know, I was feeling these pain points, and like we worked with a lot of carriers. We did a lot of like insurance replacement business. You know, folks would come to us for like, you know, the State Farms of the world would come up, we'd help them with replacements. And I could not believe how, to me, it was just basically broken, a lot of these replacement systems were. And so I just knew there was a better way to do things. And it kind of set me off this path of like, you know, moonlighting and coming up with concepts of like, how do we fix these problems? And so that basically was kind of the inception of Breiko.
So we had talked about this, but I'm putting myself in shoes of just the layman, right? So like, I think about a jeweler is, I'm about to propose to my future wife. I need a ring. She said, yes, we need wedding bands, earrings, watches, things like that. It's typically a brick and mortar location in a mall, standalone location. I'm sure you could buy stuff online as well. So that's the jewelry store retail kind of concept that your family had. I found this super interesting talking to you before, and I want to make sure that we get into this. Let's really kind of go deep into the inner workings of the jewelry industry. Because like most retail locations, it's like supply goes into a manufacturing facility, an assembly line goes into distribution, goes to the retail location. Can you kind of explain in as layman terms as possible, like the current state of the jewelry industry?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's changing really quickly, just like all retail is changing. This particular industry is different though than a lot of other retail, because it's still a touch feel product. And it's pretty much like a blind item. So like the one thing that's really different about this industry is like, Tim, if you go back and say, okay, when you were doing research on diamonds, like you literally need a trained eye, physical eye for the most part, to be able to kind of start assessing what you're actually buying. The other part of this too is for like a young, you know, for at Breiko, like 75% of what we insure is engagement rings. You know, like, it basically, it's a very large purchase. Like this is sometimes for an engagement ring purchaser, this could be like the second largest purchase in their life, right? Mm-hmm. Like buying a car, and then usually an engagement ring, and then home comes typically later. To your question, like the way the industry works, like if you're just looking at like diamonds, you know, or gemstones, you know, they're literally mined in places like Africa. Canada has mines, and all over the country, all over the world, really, depending on what type of stone you're talking about. They're mined. There's this whole underbelly. And I could go on for a really long time here, but I won't. I'll spare you and the audience. But basically, it goes through multiple different channels at that point. So it comes out of the ground. It goes to like a cutter to get faceted. And the stone gets cut because it's rough out of the ground. And then gets cut into like a gem quality. And now this is where the lines start getting blurry now, is it used to be very cut and dry. We'd go to a wholesaler, we'd go through one or two different channels before it got to retail. Now, like those lines are all blurred. Sometimes they're going directly to retail, directly online sometimes. But overall, like it's still very in-person kind of purchase. Like a brick and mortar still dominates the space. So yeah, like just pretty interesting industry.
So but the really interesting part of it, like typically you can price stuff out that's like, you know, an input into a product, an input into something that goes to retail, and it starts off like lower priced, and then it you know, there's different economics of the different transactions that happen before it gets to the end consumer. With this, to your point, like my engagement ring, I don't know if I got ripped off. I don't know if I got a good deal. I don't know what I'm looking at, right? And every diamond's different. So how do you evaluate what you're purchasing at each stage and if you know you're getting a good price on it?
So that was like one of the main issues that we were and still tackle is the idea of standardization. Like if you were to look at just take homeowners insurance, for instance, like to do an appraisal. So we're an insurance technology company. We offer a lot of technology. And one of those pieces of technology that we built is this really robust appraisal system. So we give that to jewelers, and we work with over 2,000 jewelers across the country, and we give it to them for free and say, look, we're standardizing the way appraisals are being done because it's basically the Wild West. And if you were to look at like home appraisals and home insurance and other things related to home, it's super standardized. Like there is a very cut and dry process that you use to value a home. That does not exist for valuing a diamond or an engagement ring or anything like that. So that is one problem that we're solving for. There's also another problem we're solving for, which is just the idea of just purchasing insurance should not be difficult. You know, it should be. And so with us, like you go on our website, you buy a policy in 2 minutes, like super streamlined. So there's all those issues. And then the third piece of what like to your question is trust. Like trust is a huge piece of what goes on here, you know, and it's part of what we try to address as well is like when you buy your engagement ring, you're trusting the person or the company who you're buying that from is you're really trusting that they're giving you a good deal and that you're buying what you think you're buying. Now, there's some, it's not completely lack or void. There is some like GIA, which certifies stones, like that organization has helped the industry immensely, but there's still a ton of work to be done.
I've mentioned this before to you. There was a CNBC, I don't know what the show was, but it was Marcus Lemonis. It wasn't his main show, but he was going to different industries to kind of highlight very unique industries. Mm-hmm. And he went to Jewelers Row, I think it's called, or something along those lines in Manhattan, where, you know, all the diamonds are kind of shipped in. There's buying and selling bulk and one-off at this location. It's like the middle section before it kind of hits the retail. And they were highlighting the pricing, the trust, the relationships that kind of happen across the industry but most industries aren't antiquated anymore. It's like there's a pricing system, there's efficiencies, there's technology there. But like still even today in the 2000s, you know, you have this industry that's based off of handshakes.
It is literally based on handshakes. And to your, I saw that special and that's pretty on the money. Also, another one, I mean, this is fantasized a little bit, but it's not that far off, is that the Adam Sandler movie, Uncut Gems. I don't know if you've seen that.
I saw it.
But like, it's not that far off from reality, which is mind-blowing. But just, yeah, like, for me, like living this world for my whole life, what it says to me, more so than anything, is just there's so much opportunity. It's just like, and that is one of the reasons... One of the driving passions behind Brightco was like, I was just like, there's just so much opportunity here. There's so much that can be fixed. There's so much that can be streamlined. So, I mean, I love the space. I think it's really interesting. And the other thing too, is it's hard for outsiders to come into this industry and to make a real impact. Like the way I look at it, of course, it's not impossible. Like nothing is impossible. But for us, like we talk a lot about like, well, what are the barriers to entry? Like just the fact that it is just this wonky industry alone creates some sort of barrier. So those are things that I look at too.
Let's talk about the insurance piece a little bit. Cause I think I got the ring insured. I'm not even sure really, but it makes sense. You're buying something that's the second biggest purchase at that time. You have car insurance on your first biggest purchase and the third biggest purchase. Like it makes sense. What's like the current state before you get into the Brightco solution of the insurance piece from the like the retail side, the jeweler mm-hmm. side, and then the consumer side?
Yeah. So from the consumer side, it's like a lot of other insurance lines of business. It's just traditionally kind of, you know, brokers, or there's a few players that have been around for 120 years that are just, again, we're going back to like what we were talking about jewelry, that are just super old school, you know, like paper applications. Like, you know, if you have some sort of online form, right? Like that is somewhat the norm. And you see a lot of companies across not just jewelry insurance, but all lines of insurance right now that are just really streamlining and bringing a lot of technology to the table to make just buying these products much easier. There's also this whole other concept, you know, the just underwriting, right? So like that complicates things a little bit more than just a regular consumer product where you're selling a pair of shoes, you know, you have a specific cost on your shoes and like whatever, there's LTV the customer and whatever else, you know, all these other things that you're going to look at. You know, the fact that like insurance, you don't really know. I mean, you do from data, but like you need data to understand the cost of what a customer actually costs, or the, you know, how much that product itself costs you in terms of pricing, and then the regulatory environment's the same. So you're talking about kind of this from a consumer point of view, kind of this way overblown process to buy insurance. Like you shouldn't ever have to pick up the phone, you know, like from my perspective, when I was in the jewelry space, when I was retail jewelry space, people were like constantly like, oh, I got to call this person, or like, I got to, you know, my State Farm guy or whatever it is. Like, no, like, so we have two different distribution channels, what we do at Brightco. One is, I was mentioning, we work with retail jewelers. And so we have created this like point of sale in insurance offerings. You basically, you walk into a store, you buy an engagement ring, like you will get a text message or an email from Brightco with your quote. Like you don't have to do anything. You get the quote, you click a link, you have a policy. Okay. That's the way it should be, right? And then if you're going to look for us online, our D2C product, you just go right to our website. It's the same type of process. It's like a 20 seconds to get a quote, 2 minutes to get a policy.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense. How do you underwrite something that's priced based on a handshake that you don't see, but you're kind of trusting in the retail side to like price it the right way, and that whole thing? Cause you know, you mentioned cars, like you kind of know what the going rate is for a used car that has 16,000 miles on it.
There's an MSRP, color. Right?
That's like right.
An MSRP.
Mm-hmm. How do you, with integrity for your own business based on the claims that could come in and everything like that, like what is that process, or was that already kind of there because the State Farms of the world kind of had that kind of figured out?
So what we've done is we built, so one of my co-founders, he's a fully credentialed actuary and a data scientist, and we built pricing algorithms. And so this is super unique, like no other insurance company is doing this in this space. And essentially what that is if you give me the specs of an item, I can tell you the wholesale value. Our algorithms and our system will tell you the wholesale value of this item is X. The typical retail markup in this particular area of the country is Y. There's other variables that'll go in, but like this is the wholesale. This is how much it costs to replace. This is the retail. So we don't have to rely on like, and this is just a huge advantage that we have, is we don't have to rely on third parties to tell us how much something's actually worth. Mm. My system knows. So we use that system. It goes into our underwriting. We use the system, same type of system for our claims processing. So it allows us to, you know, we don't have to go around and call a third party to try to figure out or use any systems for that matter to figure out how much a replacement should be. We're able to spit that out instantaneous. Like we know within a minute, like, here you go, here's the report, this is how much the claim, and it just streamlines the front end, it streamlines the back end. And so those are some of the things that we look at.
Interesting. I love it. Yeah. I want to get back to your co-founder in a second. That's sure. Probably super valuable to have a co-founder that's an actuary that has that type of experience. That makes a lot of sense. Hitting on the insurance piece for jewelry a little bit more, I'm curious, like how many claims come in, and how is there trust that the claim is legit? Like if you were to run your car into a pole, you have to take it to a body shop that did some work that said, here's how much it cost. There's a receipt of the transaction. Same thing with a house. If something happens to the house, how does that work in the jewelry space?
Yeah. So it's a good question. From our perspective, from Brightco's perspective, a lot of there's a different angles, but one of the more important things for us is the upfront underwriting and making sure that we're bringing the risk that we really want. And it's one of the reasons why our pricing, we have the best pricing and the best coverage in the industry for our product. But also, we're pretty stringent in terms of underwriting. So we, upfront, and this is all automated, by the way. So everything's built on the back end of our system. And we're looking at a whole bunch of different data points to say, okay, this is the risk we want. That's the number one, that is one of the most important things, is just making sure you're bringing the right risks in front. So you're trying to mitigate anything on the back end. Now, on the claim side, to what you're asking, is it depends. So I'll give you an example. A damage claim is pretty simple, right? Send us a photo of the item. We're able to assess that immediately and then take it to a jeweler, or we can recommend it. That's easy. Loss is different. If there's theft, we'll potentially require a police report or something like that. So there's things, we have tools in our tool belt that we use, and it's really kind of taking the whole holistic approach and looking at all the angles. And when you put that all together, ultimately it amounts into writing a good book of business and profitable book of business. And so that's kind of, that's high level. It gets really, I could go way into the weeds, but I will spare everybody from doing that.
No, that makes sense.
Those are the kinds of things we look at.
It makes a lot of sense. Seems like a little bit more of a challenge than the other industries that we had mentioned, for sure. Let's get into the founding story a little bit. So most of the listeners, entrepreneurs, they're in the tech scene in Chicago. They have an idea. They want to start a business. We have a lot of founders like yourself on the show. You're at the jewelry store. Potentially you got this path to kind of take over one day. What drew you towards your own entrepreneurship? Was there a trigger event? Maybe get into the co-founding story and we could kind of take it from there.
Yeah. The trigger event was a long tail event. It was really what I was talking, when I'm processing claims, I was mentioning, for a lot of these insurance companies, that was the triggering event. It was this is broken, broken, something is messed up, this needs to be fixed. The funny thing, this is the funny thing for me, it was obvious to me, but then when I started going out and having conversations, even with people that are pretty close to this thing, people would think I was kind of crazy, or that they weren't seeing this. This was really interesting. People weren't seeing what I was seeing. And the first thing I would say is I actually think that's a good thing. So if you're an entrepreneur and you see something and you're but you also have to have some sort of level of conviction, right? You have to really believe in what you're going after here, which I did, because I saw it and I felt it. I felt those people. But I think it's actually kind of a good thing when people are like, oh no, you're crazy. This doesn't make, it's kind of oh, you know, I might've uncovered something that's not obvious. So that was one thing. And then, really I spent a lot of time doing just a huge amount of research and doing a lot of networking. It was fun. I was having a really good time doing this. I was consuming, my nights and weekends. My wife at that point was sort of okay, what's happening here? What's going on? And don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. There's something here. There's something here. I did a lot of that. And then ultimately, all of those networking and having fun doing that is when I met my co-founder. Somebody, a mutual friend who's an underwriter, introduced us. And this was when the light bulb really went off, just in general, was, he has lots of insurance knowledge. And so he's like, let me do some background research on the insurance side, on this line of business. And it was the same thing. It matched up. So I was seeing this from the jewelry side. And then when he basically dug into the insurance side and was like, yep, there's problems here. When those things matched up, it was there's a business here. And at that point, we literally, maybe this was old school for us, but we put together this really robust business plan. In the insurance industry, you don't just, we had people telling us just go out there and try to start writing policies and manage it via Excel spreadsheet document. And you cannot do that in insurance. So like, we needed to get a partner, a big partner, you know, involved. And so what we decided to do was like, look, we're going to build the most ridiculous business plan we possibly can. And it ended up being like a 30, 40 page business plan with actuarial exhibits, with like everything that if you were to go to an insurance company, we wanted to just impress them. Mm-hmm. And we started pitching reinsurance companies, and we got just based on our experience and based on our business plan. And we got a couple companies right away interested. And then we ended up getting letters of intent. And then we got a deal with a large global reinsurance company. And at that moment it was like, okay, I have to leave my job. This is now what we're doing. We're raising, you know, seed money and all the rest. And that's basically, in a nutshell, the founding story.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, because, you know, you processed insurance stuff, but yeah, the reality is the insurance business is pretty complex in a lot of different facets. So, you know, kudos to you for pounding the pavement and, you know, running into your business partner that way. And I would imagine that you kind of complement each other in a lot of senses when decisions are made, for sure.
Yeah, we do. It's a really unique part of our team. And it's not, you know, I have other co-founders as well that cover the tech side and marketing piece. And, you know, I love my team. Like, I feel like we have a very unique team. And so that was part of the package. You know, when we went out to sell ourselves, it's like, you're betting on a business plan and you're betting on an idea at that point from a seed perspective, you know, that was that. So, but it was, I was really hanging my hat on our team, and I forever will.
Love it. Love it. So the total addressable market for this sounds like all the jewelers that are processing insurance, right? And then consumers that are buying jewelry, right? So that's pretty big market on its own. Have you thought about maybe different use cases that the same like pain applies that this painkiller solution could help optimize? Or is this just, we're going to go a mile deep, an inch wide on the jewelry space?
Yeah, it's answers both. So the latter is like, to me, the most important thing is just at this stage is really owning this piece of it. And like, I feel like if you become a total generalist, like you lose focus. And I feel like there's a time and place for that, but ultimately we want to conquer this market first. Now, when I say both, there's some very tangentially related products that we are going to be very well positioned, and we are well positioned, and we're getting to the point right now where we are starting to really make an impact in this industry. And, you know, we're getting to the point where we're saturating to a bit and really competing here. And so we are starting to look at other products, and it's really about, you know, what marries well with, you know, like I mentioned, like we're capturing a lot of engager rings and engager ring customers. Like, what other products and services does that particular customer want or need at this moment in their life, right? And so those are the things that we're looking at, because ultimately, at the end of the day, like, we are capturing like a life event. Like, this is a big milestone for somebody. And so like, they're going into, so what do we know for sure is happening after you buy an engagement? Like, you're getting married. What happens when you're getting married? You know, you're going to shop for all of these wedding related products and services. And so like, that's one of the kind of quote unquote pipelines that we're looking at. And there's a couple others too, but I'm pretty jazzed though. Like, we see a lot of opportunity.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's a good feeling. That's a good feeling. What was the most stressful point of this whole journey for you? Again, we have some listeners that are like, oh, I got an idea and I'm scared, but maybe if Justin or Dustin did it, we could do it. So what was the worst point, and maybe what was the proudest moment that you've had up until this point? I know it's still early.
Yeah. So, oh man, that's a super good question. I think with most startups, like, cash and capital and capital raising is super intense, super rewarding. Like, when you're able to close around, you know, like, it's it's a milestone. It is not, I mean, it is something that consumes time, and it is something that is, you need to be paying attention to pretty much all the time, because if you run out of money, you're done. So that was always stressful. I'm sure it will always will be stressful, especially the very early days. Like, we're still early stage, but very early days, that's like critical. And so, like, we were just, you know, those types of things were challenging. You know, launching, like, for on the positive side, when, like, really proud moments, like just launching the product was a huge milestone for us. You know, insurance is different. Like I mentioned, it's not, hey, we can just put together a prototype and like launch in a soft launch capacity. You have to do, it took us so long to get our product together, because you have to go get it approved by every single state. Like, you have to get insurance companies, you know, involved to be able to write, just to be able to write one insurance policy. It's just a massive effort. So like getting to that point was a very proud moment for me. And we have a couple proud moments coming up soon. I don't know when this is going to launch, but there will be some more news coming out about Brightco soon. So to be continued on the proud moments as
well. I love it. Well, I'm sure there's going to be many more to come. I was talking to an aspiring founder this week, and she like left her day to day. She was in the HR kind of like people space, was doing kind of some consulting, and then came up with a really good like idea for a service offering that she could do that wasn't consulting. And I'm like, this is great. There's a market for this. Like, you, good for you. And then she finished the conversation with, hey, if you have any like consulting potential opportunities, kind of let me know. I'm taking this job full time starting Monday now. And, you know, so my initial reaction and advice to her, and it's easy for me to say, because I ripped the bandaid off. I started this. There was some really shitty times for sure, but we got some momentum now. It's easier for me to say, but I'm like, you have to kind of rip the bandaid off and just go. Like, you have a good idea. You're passionate about it. There's fear for sure. And everyone's in a different like financial situation. Like, I didn't start this when I wanted to, because I was saving, knowing that I'd be less stressed out for the 2+ years that I wasn't paying myself. Right. And I wonder from your perspective, like, what advice would you have given your journey to someone that is like Dustin, has a good idea, you know, maybe there's some fear around like even dipping your toe in?
Yeah. Really good commentary and good question for sure. Like, there's always going to be fear, and no matter what, like, at least for me, like, but I live off the fear. Like, you learn to use it to your advantage, and you learn to say, look, this is a good thing. Like, fear is good. Like, that means that you're going for it, right? Like, but you need a level of conviction. Like, if you do not have a level of conviction for what you're doing, you might as well not do it. Like, and the other thing, like you say, like ripping the bandaid off, like, there is, you can try to de-risk it as whatever you're looking to do as much as you possibly can. There is no way that you're ever going to completely de-risk something. You're going to have to jump at some point. And also, like, the other thing that I would always look at for me personally was always like, what's the risk of not doing it? Right. Mm-hmm. So like, if you really take, I always encourage people to take like the longest view you possibly can. And like, this, take this for what you will, but like, I would take the view of like, I'm on my deathbed and I'm looking back and I'm saying, did I not go for that? Like, why did I not go for that? Like, what are the regrets that you may or may not have at later stages? And those like will all factor into like the risk that you have actually taken by not taking that risk. And so like those would be things I would encourage folks to like look at. And also, it's exciting and it's scary, but like once you get into it, like there's moments, like I've had moments for sure where it's like you're in the deep end, it's the middle of the night and it's dark and you're treading water, but you don't know which way particularly you're going, but you know, you just need to keep treading water. Like you can't let yourself sink. And so it's kind of that idea of just keep going, pushing forward. So like those would be the things that I would say to an entrepreneur looking to start something new, like look at those things and take the longer view.
Well, one thing that was helpful for me is once I started surrounding myself with other people that have done it, have like taken the plunge, or, you know, I'm not shy to reach out on LinkedIn to someone. Hey, you started a business. I wanted to start a business. Can I get like 10 minutes to pick your brain? You know, like 1 out of 10 say yes, but like I get so much out of those conversations. And whether it's like listening to a podcast like this, when you start to really kind of evaluate the folks that have done it before, before that, there's like psychological size, like, oh, that person's a CEO. Like there's a psychological size with that. That's hard. That's scary. They're probably really good. Like they founded a company, their company's 20 people, their company's 200 people. There's psychological size to that. But the more I surrounded myself with people, read biographies, listened to podcasts, it's like, you were me before you did it. It's like, why can't, I don't know, Tim's a recruiter, salesperson, but like Dustin was a jeweler and, you know, Steve Jobs was doing that before. Like it kind of like demystifies and puts us on a level playing field that we're all human. And yeah, there's got to be preparation and work ethic and you have to have a good idea and like all these different factors. But in terms of you got a good idea and you're the person to do it and not doing it, it just makes sense to do it. Put yourself in a position where you feel comfortable doing it, but like do it sooner rather than later. You don't want to have any regrets.
No, and you're right. Like everybody was in that moment at some point. Like you start from somewhere. Like, and the other thing to take the flip side is most entrepreneurs, including myself, like completely understand that and want to give back. Like people gave to me, like in the same way that you kind of telegraph it, and like people, like 1 out of every 10, somebody will say, yeah, let's hop on a call, happy to talk. And then all of a sudden, like that person was like incredibly helpful or just like provided perspective or whatever it might be. And I had those people too, where it's like, hey, let's just, you know, that were gracious enough to go sit down and get a cup of coffee with me. And the truth of the matter is, like, I didn't quite know what I was doing. And right. I learned. And, you know, that's the other piece of it. It's like, you're not going to know everything. Like you have to learn, like you have to start somewhere. And so like, I don't think anyone should pretend like they know everything. And it's a learning experience. The whole thing is about, you know, like basically climbing rings and just sort of like taking one step forward and just constantly making sure that you're improving and getting better. And then you end up somewhere awesome. And so like, to that point, like, yes, like people can be mentors, people can help. And there's a lot of, I love the Chicago's got a great startup community. You know, you're super active, Tim. And like these things, like what we're doing right now is just really good for the community. And people are happy to help. So like, yeah, reach out for sure.
I did consulting, but I had a 2.5 year non-compete before I could start this. So, you know, I did some consulting work with small business owners and tech companies in the, you know, 10 to 30 employee kind of range. And my background is sales and sales leadership. So I'd provide sales consulting. Oh, you need help with sales. This is what I do. But it gave me a very interesting look into a lot of different businesses at the 3 to 7 year mark, let's call it. And there was some like well-run companies where like founding team, they're like good managers, good leaders. They treat people the right way. They make their decision-making is pretty good. Like you can kind of like forecast that there's going to be some success. But a lot of them were at like 2 million in these are mostly service businesses, 2 million in revenue, 3 million, 5 million. And they were just like horribly run, some of these companies. Like you're looking at it and you're just like, how are you making money? Like you got a big house, like you drive a nice car, like, but no one likes you at your company, and like your customer, like you're churning through customers all the time, like low hanging fruit stuff that could get fixed. My takeaway from that was really confidence. Like this is what not to do. And if these folks can do it,
yeah,
like, all right, like I can do it. The constant was they just stuck with it.
Yeah.
There was something going on that they just like, I'm not going to give up. I'm just going to keep going. And they probably had some stress along the way, but they stuck with it. And if you can optimize those other things that maybe made them unsuccessful, you're just going to be that much further along. Sorry, go ahead.
No. You're right. There's like crazy amount of opportunity out there. There just is that even if you're not great or have fatal flaws, you could still be relatively successful. It's all right. Relative. But yeah, I mean, that's agree 100%. Though persistency is like the key thing. Like it's, I think it's like number one. Like Like I would put like curiosity and persistency on kind of those top two rings where like, if you're not persistent, like, I mean, it's one of the things I would give myself credit for is I'm very persistent. And it's a key component for an entrepreneur because you can't give up. Like, it's just like, if you have the mentality of like, there is not, giving up is not an option. We will figure out another way. And it's kind of like the idea of just hunting and pecking, where it's like, you're trying to penetrate the sphere and like, you're trying to figure out where the weak parts are. But like, you might peck here and say, oh, that's strong. Like, we can't get in there. You peck over here and be like, wait, no, this is weaker. Like, I can actually probably penetrate this area. And so there's like a lot of that kind of stuff with entrepreneurship that if you are persistent, like you will have a good chance of being successful to some level.
One of my favorite quotes is people overestimate what they can do in 1 year and people underestimate what they can do in five. And I think in entrepreneurship, I mean, it's like losing weight, it's personal finance, saving money, getting out of credit card debt, it's whatever. But that long-term view, and I think by nature, people want now, hit the fast forward button and they end up kind of giving up on themselves, probably is what we're talking about. And yeah, it's going to probably take 3 to 5 years. So if you have that longer term view, I think you're probably going to chill out a little bit more in year one, but you're going to be making decisions along the way that'll get you where you need to go. Dustin, I know we're up on time, but this has been awesome. And I was, you know, when I met you, I know you were on to great things. I'm super excited to see where Brightco goes. For folks that want to reach out either to you specifically or learn a little bit more about Brightco, how can they do that?
Yeah, I mean, they could find me on, for sure, hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm on there all the time and, you know, happy to chat.
Awesome. All right, Dustin, we'll see you around Chicago. All the best. We'll talk soon.
All right, Tim. Thanks.